Succession number 1898, Reel 3.
Commander Turner, Reel 3.
I was fortunate enough to go to a conference in the Normandy beachhead about 3 weeks after D-Day and was able to see the vast amount of naval communications equipment which had been established there to provide communication between the Navy and the forces ashore.
There was a general point you were making earlier on to me about the work of signals officers in the Navy in contrast with those in the other services. Maybe you could repeat that on tape?
I think so. I've always felt that the Naval Signal School made a strong point that the job of a signal officer was to get his messages through by whatever means were possible, even if it came down to sending a runner with a message on a stick. Now, in the Navy, signal officers were given a very wide discretion and were deeply trusted. They, if one may say that in those days, the Admiral had a Chief of Staff, and the Chief of Staff's right hand was his operations officer, and his left hand was his signal officer. Signal officers were always brought into planning at the earliest stages, and the needs for signals was very widely established. This may be due to the fact that between ships, the only means of communication were by visual signaling or radio. There's also the fact that signal officers usually coupled their job with being flag lieutenants, except in the very top commands where the flag lieutenant had necessarily to be mostly a social creature. As a result, all admirals tended to rely pretty heavily on their signal officers and to trust them to get on with their job without much reference back. This meant that the signal officer was left very much to himself as to how he got the signals through, as long as he did so.
Going to an earlier part of your career, to the interwar period in the Mediterranean, did you have anything to do with the Abyssinian crisis?
Yes. In April of 1935, I was appointed to be flag lieutenant and squadron signal and wireless officer to Rear Admiral Doyle Lahn, who was about to command the 3rd Cruiser Squadron in the Mediterranean. When the Abyssinian crisis broke in August 1935, the Mediterranean fleet evacuated Malta, as it would have been too vulnerable to possible Italian attack. The fleet went to the eastern Mediterranean, where most of it based themselves on Alexandria. But Alexandria could not readily contain the whole fleet, and Rear Admiral Doyle Lahn, with his cruiser squadron, some destroyers, and a number of other ships which arrived in the Mediterranean in connection with the crisis, went to Haifa, where we remained in a state of high alert. Shortly after arriving in Haifa, the Admiral was asked if he could turn the place into a defended base if the necessary equipment and men were sent. He said yes, and very soon afterwards, planning staff of the Mobile Naval Base arrived. The Mobile Naval Base Defense Organization had been thought up in the early 30s as it was realized that wartime might require that naval bases be established in various parts of the world which were not normally equipped to operate warships. The organization had been turned over to the Royal Marines to develop, and I think Haifa was probably the first place where it was actively used. Following the Marine officers who came to plan was the first shipment of troops and equipment. The plan was to erect 3 twin 6-inch batteries around the Bay of Aca, to lay nets, establish a mining base, establish a base for submarines, and so on. Within 48 hours of the equipment arriving, the Marines had the first 2 guns in position, concreted in, and fired their tests. We also had a signal station erected on the top of Cape Carmel. We were still part of the Mediterranean fleet and from time to time went down to Alexandria to exercise with the fleet. The Abyssinian crisis died slowly, and by early 1936 the Mediterranean fleet were able to return to Malta and resume more normal activities, including, shortly after that, the question of the Spanish Civil War. We stayed at Haifa because, with the rundown on Abyssinia, an Arab rebellion broke out, and the administration in Palestine badly needed some help. Strictly speaking, Palestine was the responsibility of the Royal Air Force, who were well developed to give external protection, but not really well organized to deal with internal disorder. There were 2 battalions of the army in Palestine, one in the south and the other just outside Haifa. We had a very close liaison with the northern one, which fortunately was the Loyal North Lancashires, an extremely efficient regiment. The fleet provided a number of men to run the Palestinian railways. Many of these men claimed that they could drive locomotives. Others had some knowledge of signalling. They certainly managed to keep a limited service running throughout Palestine, despite the Arabs frequently vandalizing the lines. We ran a couple of armored trains, which helped to keep the vandalism down at night. The ships at Haifa took over to a large extent the patrolling and of the Haifa area, thus enabling the army to deploy their troops further afield. As we were still at 4 hours' notice to proceed on other naval duties if required, we could not let our men go much beyond Haifa, as they would be necessarily recalled very quickly. It was a very interesting time. The Navy had to do a great many things which are not in the naval manuals, and did it pretty well. Admiral Lyon was an admirable choice for the job. By September of 1936, very large army reinforcements had arrived in Palestine and the need of naval help had diminished. A battleship was stationed at Haifa as a headquarters for the naval help that still went on. But we were freed and returned to ordinary fleet duties.